All right. Welcome to the RSP cast. I am Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. This is episode number 38. They are just flying by, folks. And it's about time that I brought on one Bob Harris as a guest to the show. Bob Harris works at Football Diehards. Personally, Bob's like my big brother, which, you know, I'm so honored to have him as kind of like my big brother, especially in this industry. If somehow Matt Harmon got stuck with Sigmund Bloom and I as kind of uncles in this industry, I feel extremely blessed that I have Bob. Bob has been, you know, I remember starting to write fantasy or play fantasy football in the mid 90s. And, you know, Bob's work was the work to read. It still is the work to read. You can read his work. The TFL report is one of the things that I remember reading to begin with. But then you also have him daily on Sirius XM with the Football Diehards podcast, Football Diehards show. He and Mike Dempsey, you know, just does phenomenal work. And so, Bob, before we even get into the subject, you know, thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm glad you found a topic where I wasn't required to watch film.
Yeah. Well, this is a topic that I honestly couldn't think of anyone better to do this with, because while, you know, obviously I do a lot of shows where it's more draftnik focused and I bring on, you know, some great draft analysts like Dane Brugler or some, you know, trainers or people who are, you know, studying the game on a level where they're trying to evaluate prospects. This topic I want to discuss is about, can people change, and really more, can players change? And I wanted to bring on someone who I felt like, you know, had some life experience, you know, someone who's had seen things with perspective and who reads a lot of different material and kind of brings their own take to it and doesn't just kind of spout the party line about things, you know, not like this is how things are and this is what people do. And, you know, and that's the answer that I would get from other people when I would ask things about whether people change. So, you know, for me, I thought this would be a fun conversation because it would also apply. You can also apply it back to football just from what you've seen watching players as well. So, you know, this is something that we're going to relate back to football as we get further into it. But I mean, just to start off, can people change? Why or why not?
So, yes and no. As circumstances dictate. We've heard that phrase, right? Circumstances dictate. And because circumstances dictate, that leads to things like necessity being the mother of invention and or reinvention, right? I mean, you know, external actions and forces are, you know, they can be thrust upon us and maybe they're outside our control or maybe they're of our own creation, you know, outcomes from our own decisions or reactions to those external events. They tend to demand change. And, you know, the other side of that coin is we don't want to change. You know, human nature is we want to resist change. We have a comfort zone. Changing is not easy. Changing, reinvention, all those things are difficult and require a long, hard effort. And we generally don't want to make those. But there comes a point where we tend to be forced to. And I think, you know, maturity levels have a lot to do with this. And we'll get more into this. But I mean, your ability to recognize that change is necessary is a big part of this. And that's something I didn't learn until, you know, I want to say my late 30s, and I'm probably being generous. It probably wasn't until into my 40s. And then you have to have a feedback loop that allows you to actually realize the changes you're making are benefiting you. And you know, there comes this wow moment. Oh, better decisions lead to better and even desired outcomes and a better life and all those things. And so, you know, it takes a series of those things to make change happen. You have to realize the benefits of it, I think, is the most important. But whether it's the outside circumstances or your own decision making, change is definitely possible. It's just not easy.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. And I couldn't agree more, because it's one of those situations where you need some, and when you talk about a feedback loop, you know, that feedback loop kind of takes time for you to start to acclimate to and understand whether it's a good feedback loop or not, and whether you're in a situation where you know, you're changing in a direction that's positive for you and maybe even positive for other people, if that matters. And it may matter in certain situations. You know, if you're at work, it matters whether other,
right,
you know, whether other people are noticing that or not. Whether it's personal or not, it might be something that's more internal. And I think that we think about change, and oftentimes change takes, you know, it may take years. You know, it's not something that happens in a week. And I think that when we look at football, oftentimes we're looking at things within the span of weeks or months or a year. And we often see that it isn't that way. I mean, a good example of that before we kind of go on to, you know, the next question is, I think about Steve Young talking about in his retirement, early in his retirement, that just when he started to feel like that he was evolving as a football player and seeing the game at the highest level and making, and that's a change.
Yeah.
You know, being able to see that is his body started changing and deteriorating. So, you know, people often talk about the football players. I've had, you know, people on this podcast, like my friend, Eric Stoner, who's one of, you know, one of my favorite guests who writes at the site occasionally now, and he talks about, you know, players don't change. And I thought that's kind of the basis of this conversation that I wanted to have. So, you know, where, you know, whether we're talking about individuals or players, go ahead. What were you gonna say?
Just quickly, I mean, you bring something up about the time period, and the, you know, and that's something you notice that's unique to me about football. And one of the things that I've always used to help understand the game, or to, you know, maybe to gain an edge just playing fantasy football or whatever, is the things change every week in the NFL. The opponent, the venue, the game plan, the personnel, the packages employed, all these things. So what does a head coach want to do? He wants things to be as much the same every week. You know, he wants that continuity for the sake of his players. So a lot of decision-making coaches make is based on that desire for continuity in a game where continuity is impossible because it's such a week-to-week game. You can use that to your advantage by understanding that coach's desire to keep that continuity in place while adapting to the thing. And most coaches have, you know, you come to realize they have a way of handling that becomes pretty predictable.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's very true. So are there conditions where you feel like someone can or can't change that may counter your first response about this? Like, what are some conditions where people can't change?
So, and I'm going to speak from experience of my own and not, you know, not without, you know, projecting this onto other people. So I've created and dealt with conditions that, you know, both made change easy and made change hard. And I think there's things that, you know, addiction is something I battled a series of them in my life. And at some point I've come to realize that changing my addictive, obsessive personality is not something I'm capable of on my own. And I've been unable or unwilling to seek outside help. So I've learned how to deal with that, to make different changes, right? Maybe not curing the problem, but replacing the habits, replacing bad habits with good has worked for me. That's a, you know, is that the best possible change? Maybe not. Maybe, you know, maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. Do you like the addictive, obsessive me, Matt, or would you like me to be a different me? And those are the things that we're looking at, right? The, you know, changes in your own nature are hard to make, but over time and with maturity, you can understand your weaknesses. And if you can't, you know, turn them around or turn them into strengths, you can find ways to effectively change and deal with them and mitigate the outcomes that have come from those bad decisions, right? Or those, you know, and that, I think that's, those are the things, there are things that I think you cannot change that are immutable almost, or for me have been. But the actions and the results and the outcomes, I can change those. I can make adjustments. And you know, whether it's out of, you know, look, we make changes for lots of reasons, not the least of which might be stubbornness and or spite, right? Someone says, you can't do that. Oh, the hell I can't, you know? Right. I mean, you know, and that's part of my nature is that stubbornness and spite, whether it's even, you know, even at the point of spiting myself. I mean, I will cut my nose off in a second if it, you know, to make my point. So I think those are, you know, that's the conditions of change are, you know, maybe whether it's actually, you know, a medical circumstance or, you know, a mental issues or whatever that I've had that have been hard to change, I just work around them. So yes, you cannot change, but you can change, right? I think it's a both. It's two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, I think, you know, I had this discussion with the Mrs. RSP at one point, and we were talking about it. And I think for her, she said, I don't think you can change how you feel about things, but you certainly can change how you behave.
Right.
And I think that fits into another thing that I remember hearing in the past, which is that there are companies that realize when they manage people and develop people, or leaders who manage and develop people, especially in teams that they work with them, is that maybe the player's weaknesses will always remain their weaknesses, but you can learn how to use that player or personnel's strengths to continue building on those strengths to the point that it minimizes those weaknesses. So it's that way of, as you said, being able to look at someone and saying, okay, well, they're obviously stubborn, which makes them persistent and determined if you apply that with the right compass direction.
Right.
And then if you have someone who's obsessive or has an addictive personality, then yeah, if you can turn that behavior into habit, you know, being a habit forming and disciplined and focused on a certain area, then suddenly you've turned things that can be very destructive into highly constructive behavior.
It's exactly right. And that's what you'd find, you know, I mean, look, I went through multiple addictions, alcohol, various drugs, eating, and you know, one replaced the other. And then it wasn't until you found, oh, look at this great job where I can just put all my energy into that. And you know, I mean, and that led to other problems, right? The obsessive desire to do that. And finally, you come to realize, and it's over time, it's an evolution, which I think change best is, right? Changes that happen over time. But then you find out, oh, look, I can be as easily addicted to things that are good for me as I can to the things that are bad for me. Yeah. But again, it's an evolution, and it all is based on that feedback loop. You have to have that developed where you realize, oh, look, the outcome is the desired outcome here. I'm going to make more decisions like this. And that's, you know, that's how incrementally you can make these changes. And I think, you know, it's not just an individual thing. It can work for organizations, people, teams, governments, everybody.
Yeah. And it's funny how it's brought up, because, you know, you think, how does this relate to the NFL? And I think we talk about, or you can look at certain players and the things we celebrate about players, you know, the fanatical work ethic of a Peyton Manning, you know, or of quarterbacks in general, and how they're expected to be, you know, the first ones in the building and the last ones out, and that they need to be studying copiously at all times. And that, you know, somebody who's, you know, someone like Paxton Lynch, who was, you know, playing video games more often than he was studying, you know, wasn't celebrated, even though, you know, he was probably one of the top quarterbacks in college football at the time to earn this opportunity. So the talent was there, you know, on a certain level, but the ability to continue to work to get to really play to that talent at the next level wasn't. Whereas you have people like Nick Mullins at San Francisco 49ers, who was undrafted, but here he is on a field alone, pumping in crowd noise into his headphones, you know, basically calling plays by himself and running the playbook on his own. Chad Kelly was doing that, you know, in Denver for his first year. And you can see, though, that certain things, you know, certain behaviors, if you don't have them, you know, redirected with a good positive feedback loop, you can, you know, they can self-destruct easily if you don't really get them stabilized, you know,
right. But on the other end. And I've mentioned maturity, and there's, you know, people mature at different rates. There are people I see who are in their late teens, early 20s, who make amazing decisions. And I look at them and I'm dumbfounded, because it took me, again, I was, you know, I mentioned I was being generous when I said, you know, into my 30s, it was probably into my 40s before I really understood, before the rewiring and understanding the process involved in change really started to take effect. But that's not the same. Everyone is different. And you see, you know, young people, we see players every day, and they're probably the players we don't talk about who have already learned, look, oh, good decisions lead to good outcomes. And so we tend to focus on the other end of that spectrum. And look, and understandably so, I mean, that's, you know, that's what's presented to us, but we shouldn't dismiss the notion that, that there are a hell of a lot of people out there who get it and make changes every day for the better. And their processes are well ahead of others.
Yeah, but it's true. I mean, I think about, you know, I think about studying to be a musician, and I had certainly an obsessive outlook in terms of how I worked. And if it was something I was passionate about, I was really obsessive about it. And then when that went away in my early 20s, when I decided to change direction and that went away, I remember thinking about all the ways that I would indulge in that kind of obsessive behavior about things. And it was usually just stuff that was, you know, that really didn't lead to anything productive. I didn't do anything unbelievably destructive, but I certainly wasted a lot of time. And I could say that that in itself was probably a destructive thing. But as I, you know, it was trying to find something that would be constructive and how to redirect that energy into something like that. And it took me till, you know, it probably took me until my early to mid 30s where I was like, okay, I found what that is. And, you know, we're having this conversation today because of that. But it's, you know, when you talk about players being that young and being able to do that, you know, I think about, you know, like you said, I think about what I was like between 18 and 23, you know, at that age range. And even though I was working hard and studying, I didn't know how to work right.
Right.
I didn't always know how to relate to people in a way to be able to maximize what it is that I was trying to do. Did I have the confidence to be able to ask people the right questions? And if you, even if you ended up in a good situation around people who were supposed to provide you opportunities, there are still a lot of other people gunning for that same face time and work time and individual time. And you may not ask them the right questions. You might be in the right neighborhood, but not be able to knock on the right door. And even when you do knock on the right door, you don't know what to say to someone, you know, when they answer it, to get what you need from the situation.
Right. We thrust people, you know, in particular in football, we thrust young men who may or may not be ready into awkward positions of sudden wealth, fame. I mean, you know, and if the maturity in the maturity isn't there, the feedback loop isn't established, you know, expecting a great outcome is very unrealistic, right? So, you know, that's part of, you know, the whole change is there have to be people around to help them in this, because it's not necessarily a natural thing. For some it is, right? I mean, we all see people, and again, we don't talk about everyone who's out there making great decisions every day because they're not that interesting. We focus on the guys that are making the poor decisions because the squeakier wheels get the grease.
Yeah. I mean, so when you think about that, and especially with younger guys and some of the pitfalls that can be there, I mean, is it realistic to expect NFL prospects to change? Let's talk about just how they play, like changing how they play, for instance, right, as a starting point, not even the off-field stuff. I mean, you know, one example is, you know, you look at Derek Carr. You know, Derek Carr always seems to, you know, short circuit a little bit with a certain amount of pressure. You know, he did that at Fresno State. He seems to do that with the Raiders, you know, to a certain degree still now. But then you have someone like Le'Veon Bell who, you know, I guess maybe this fits into that same series as where it's harder to fix a weakness than it is to maximize a strength. Derek Carr short circuits under pressure. Well, that's hard to change. And so they're going to have to really provide a lot of protection around him for him to maximize his strengths. But Le'Veon Bell, while he was a patient runner at Michigan State, he just became even more patient behind a better line. So I think that's kind of, I was going to bring up those two examples, but as I'm asking the question, I'm realizing that maybe the answer here is that, again, players change in certain ways. Their negatives don't change, but their positives can be built upon to minimize those negatives.
Right. Well, I mean, look, I remember all the talk. Kenyan Drake couldn't pass block, right? And now he can. I mean, you know, skills can be acquired, and coaching helps with those. But, you know, in general, I mean, you know, the you know, more basic base level changes are difficult with players, because we have to realize, you know, athletes, NFL players in particular, are unique. You know, they've been raised not to back down, you know, and I talk about this when you think about negotiations with the NFL and NFLPA. You know, this is not like, I mean, you're talking guys who, when you punch them in the mouth, they punch back, right? They're not going to sit there and go, oh, wow, this is a bad situation, because their entire lives have been spent competing and fighting their way out of bad circumstances. And I think that has to be taken into account when we set our expectations for how they change and the way they change. And I go back to what I said, talked about the stubbornness. I mean, that's part of what makes an athlete successful. That stubbornness, that unwillingness to back down, that, you know, that come punch you in the mouth if you push them kind of mentality does not always make it change the first choice, right? You have to change. Oh, really? You think so? So that's something that I think players have to contend with. But I think in general, you kind of nailed it. I mean, can we change the skills? Can we improve the skills? Can we add skills? Yes, those are changes we can make. Can we go down to a more base level and make changes? That's more on the player, and that more comes with time and maturity.
Yeah, and I think that there's also maybe a factor of where fear comes into play. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that, you know, it's such a, when people hear the word that a player is soft or he's afraid, it's a massive insult to a player in a contact sport. And I think that then you start to listen to players who've already, you know, they've retired, former players, and then they talk about when they were afraid or when someone intimidated them, and they laugh about it now. But during the time of their career, you say that to them, and you might as well be telling them, you know, that you've basically knocked on their grandmother's door and like slapped her across the face, because it's the biggest insult to a player, because players are in this state, I think, at this time of their career where you can't show fear, and you don't want anyone to see that you're afraid. But I think that it's there's always those moments, I think, where you see it on the field. And you can call it what it is, but you're going to get people, especially fans who are very tribal, to respond in a manner where it's just going to go all out of control. So as analysts, we don't necessarily say Derek Carr reacted with fear in the pocket. You know, it's not to say that he's a coward, because he gets up and keeps going every day and deals with the hits and tries to figure out solutions. It's just that his fear doesn't allow him to be as good of a decision maker as a result of that. And I think that when we look at, you know, and I was listening to something yesterday or last night, I was watching some NBA stuff about players talking about other players. And Chris Webber was talking about how he always saw himself as a really tough guy. And his rookie year, he threw an elbow at a guy by the name of Terry Cummings. And if you remember who he was like a pretty big power forward with the San Antonio Spurs for a while, and I believe with the Milwaukee Bucks. And Terry Cummings was kind of one of those guys with like old school strength who, you know, he said, the first time I threw an elbow, Terry Cummings grabbed me by the arm, and I looked down and I thought, for the first time in my life, wow, that guy's got like that grandpa strength who like grabs you and just like lifts you up. and he said, young man, you don't want to throw any elbows tonight. I
just yeah. You know, you said something there though that gets me. I mean, tribal is the new code word for insane. Right. Fans are tribal. Yes. By tribal, you mean insane.
Thank you for like clarifying, like being real, like
we cover a sport where Tom Brady is both the greatest of all time and the most despicable cheater ever to live. So, you know, that gives you an idea of the tribalism or insanity. And you also mentioned something else too about, you know, players showing weakness. I mean, that's part that also makes it hard to change, because sometimes, you know, admitting that you have a weakness is enough to make you want to shut the hell up in a locker room, right? It's not the accepted thing. It's not what you do. It goes back to the stubbornness. I don't have any weaknesses, and so it's hard to change what you don't admit you have, right? And that's an issue I think for players to overcome. You think about a guy like Tom Brady, the greatest of all time and most hated despicable cheater ever. Look at how he's changed and changed his approach to the game and been willing to admit, oh, look, I don't have all the answers. Let me go talk to people. Let me go look into diet. Let me look into pliability and flexibility. Let me see if I can be the guy who changes the way we look at how longevity of players. And that requires a great deal of, I mean, that's not an easy thing because you're admitting that the things you're doing aren't right. I mean, those are the kind of changes. And look what he's changing. I mean, in general, not to be a Tom Brady kiss ass, but I mean, he's changing the way I think a lot of quarterbacks are looking at how their careers are going to play out. Right. So that's the thing. I mean, and it adds to the feedback loop. People see someone successfully change. Oh, wow. Look what they did. I can do that. NFL being a copycat league, as we all know, ask the Chicago Bears, who watched the success the Rams had, you know, by ditching a stodgy conservative coach and bringing in a sharp, young, innovative offensive mind to turn their young quarterback around. And, you know, that's the key to the franchise. These things, you know, successful change begets more change, right? And so that's all part of the feedback loop too. But that first step, admitting you have a weakness, that's not easy in an environment like the NFL.
Yeah, and there's even guys who that even though they see what Tom Brady's doing and want to do some of that, that's hard for them to even go through that process because they still can't admit to it.
Right.
And you know, I look at it this way. I remember reading Jim Brown's autobiography several years ago, and the thing that struck me the most from reading that was him talking about that every player is afraid. No one talks about it in the locker room, but they are. And, you know, I kind of look at it jokingly is that, you know, he talks about who threw up before the game,
right,
and that players throw up before the game and coaches throw up before the game. But nobody's afraid because, you know, they all just add, you know, ate bad lettuce one day. That was all it was, is that they had romaine and they were, you know, they all football players just like romaine salads. And that's why they, you know, why they throw up before a game. It has nothing to do with fear. But I mean, you look at that. And I think that that's part of the issue is that how do players deal with fear and how do you figure out how should we expect players to, you know, change through that? And what are some ways that we go through that? And that's maybe something we'll talk about a little bit later. But, you know, how would we, you know, let's talk about like off-field issues, because, I mean, you think about players like Josh Gordon or you think about a player like Tyreek Hill or Joe Mixon. And on one level, you know, we could delve into the rabbit hole of how the NFL, some teams and some, you know, coaches or some GMs or owners or some communities may be enabling bad behavior by protecting players in ways where we don't hear about it, you know, or we come to hear about it years later about how the police officer looked the other way with a traffic accident that involved booze, or how we never hear about the player who has, you know, who's world famous and, you know, a spokesman for several companies run off the road, you know, after drunk driving and the car mysteriously disappears from the accident scene and is, you know, fixed by someone and you don't know whether that's a true story or not, you know, or, you know, how teams try to mitigate or, you know, or let's, I don't know, we don't have a videotape of someone punching their wife in a hotel, you know, in a hotel elevator, you know, but I mean, things like that, that you see that teams either try to protect themselves or protect the player. And then there's other teams that, you know, try and work actively with players when it comes to behavioral issues off field. I mean, what should we expect with, you know, from players who are young when it comes to these off field issues? I mean, because some guys, you look at like Tyreek Hill and you think what he did, you know, what he did from a domestic violence standpoint, you know, you read about it and you go, wow, that's just horrific to watch, to know about. But at the same time, you see what he's trying to do to make amends. And if that's the case, to try and like fix his life and move forward, and how he's worked with, you know, and even the victim that he, you know, is in the relationship with, and how they've worked things out. You know, on the one hand, you're going to have people who may say, well, this victim obviously is still, you know, hasn't really, shouldn't even be with this guy, should never have been in this situation, and should be out of it. And, you know, and they could be victim shaming that person. But I think that there's a, you know, oftentimes we don't understand the depths of, you know, the relationships and how people, you know, what the inner workings of this. We see the police report, we read the newspaper, and we don't really know the depth of the situation. So, you know, I'm not really asking a good question here, but, you know, when I state kind of some of these points of, and some of these things that I see, you know, where are you at when you're looking, you know, you're just reading about the draft and you suddenly hear about something sordid that the player did or is involved with or something troubling, you know, when do you look at that and go, I think that's a player who might be able to grow up and grow through this. And this is something that you don't want that player anywhere near a team.
Well, my initial thought is when I come across these things is I don't know. And that's something we should all keep in mind. I don't know everything about this. I know what I'm told about this. I know what the information out there is. I don't know. So we live in a black and white world that isn't really black and white. It is right. A palette of grays that is, you know, so many shades deep that we can't even fathom them. Yet we want to boil it all down to black and white, right or wrong, this or that. It's a problem, right? We can't, you know, and it creates problems for these people who are caught in these circumstances that are very complicated. And look, I'm not going to excuse anyone's behavior. The behavior is what it is, and it's despicable or whatever it is. Yeah, we can bottom line that. Can we bottom line the person? Can we decide that he's a despicable person or she's a despicable person based on one act at some point in their life? There, you know, if we all like to think we're evolving people in the process of making changes and growing and evolving, should we not give somebody else the benefit of the doubt and assume that they can't do the same thing, especially when it's a young person? You know, so there are different multiple components to this, of course. I mean, you know, you mentioned it, you know, athletes, I mean, by nature tend to be entitled and coddled. Especially in very young formative years, you know, whether it's high school or heading into college, you know, they're given breaks that other people don't get. And that's part of the problem, right? I mean, if we want to just, you know, say it's a black and white issue, he's bad. How did he get bad? What made it, what led to these decisions? What led to the choices that put him in this position that he, you know? And so, look, I think it's always a broader thing. And sadly, I don't think that that's ever going to matter anymore. I mean, you know, according to my 24/7 cable TV outlets, I mean, you know, everything is a moment in time, and we're going to decide what people are based in that moment in time. It's sad. And I think, you know, look, people can change. I mean, the worst people, people who commit the horrible acts can learn from those acts. I mean, that's what our entire justice system is based on, right? You can, I mean, not right. Punishment, but rehabilitation is what it should be. And if that's the basis of that, then we all have to believe that people can change, that people can alter their behaviors, realize the error of their past ways, and become better from them. So I'd like to think that, yes, this is the direction everyone's going. I don't think everyone gets that benefit of the doubt, though.
No, I agree. And I think that, I look personally, the way that I often look at this situation is, especially when it comes to someone who, you know, is evaluating talent, is that I look at it this way, is that, yes, I understand that the odds are likely that someone who's committed a crime off the field or has been arrested for a crime off the field or has an addiction or has certain behavioral issues that may short circuit their career. I certainly understand that the odds are likely that that player at that age and that level of maturity isn't going to change in time enough for them to be a benefit to an organization as a player. Like, that's, you know, if you're just going to be an odds based person and play the numbers, then you just pretty much say across the board, these people aren't going to matter in the matrix of what goes on and how it impacts what I try to assess and do. That's the simplistic way of looking at it, I decide. And for me, you know, that's, if you're playing it safe, that's how you do it. But if you're going to want to study talent and you really want to dig in and get into the weeds and not just take, to be honest with you, the wuss way out, because that's a wuss way out in my industry with this. To me, it's like, if you're just going to say, I'm avoiding them all, then you're just like, okay, great, because there's going to be, you know, maybe there's 10 players who would be classified in that area, but two of them may forever change the way the game is played, and they may actually change as human beings to a degree that you wrote them off way too early, and it would have impacted you and other people's lives in a way that was amazing. And so I think that it's important that, you know, maybe it's a hard thing to do, but at the same time, you kind of try and look at these on a case by case scenario and understand that, yes, it isn't just that simple. And unfortunately, you touched on it. I mean, you touched on it greatly to talk about the 24/7 news networks, because, you know, someone who's worked with people in media outside of football and also just seen people in media inside of football and the way they ask questions and what they ask of these people. Some of these folks in media really just don't have an understanding of human nature at all. They don't really even care. They just want to be on TV. They just want to look a certain way, have certain things, behave, you know, and they take this very formulaic approach, or they do what they're asked to do in a certain way to get a certain, you know, to get a certain response. And it's not about really thinking long term about the relationship with the person that they may be dealing with in front of them.
Right.
And
these are all bottom line businesses, whether they're football teams, news channels, media outlets, whatever. They're doing this to make money in the end. So their decisions are not going to necessarily be altruistic, but we see teams, and in some cases, you know, individuals involved with teams that do make these more altruistic choices and try to work with people. But in the end, it's towards the bottom line. Let's think about the Patriots. I mean, what team brings in more troubled people? You mentioned Josh Gordon. I mean, they've built a culture. They do things a certain way. They lend a stability. It's a great situation. They want an outcome, though, right? They're looking to win championships. And maybe they found a way that, hey, look, if we can help these talented people who have been troubled in past circumstances overcome that, it benefits us. So, I mean, it's a weird kind of symbiotic relationship, but I think it works for people, and it can work for people.
Yeah. And I think that we can expect, to me, I mean, I would think I've worked with people who have certainly had their share of things on a resume or in a background check where you go, okay, you know, I'm going to have my manager ask me questions about this person when I sign off on hiring them. Like, I, you know, because on the surface, they're going to have that bottom line kind of judgment. Like, you're going to bring this person in and they're going to be dealing with X, Y, and Z, and they have A, B, and C on their record. Like, really? You know, why are you going to do that? Or, and I think that there's a point where you have to, you know, when you go through that, you have to make sure that you understand where that person's coming from, where, you know, whether you can believe they've changed, and what is it that you would look for to see that potential for change, or that they are already in that feedback and they're starting to create feedback loops to have positive change, and where that you can put them around other people who are going to encourage that and add to that feedback loop. And I think the Patriots are a team that creates that positive feedback loop. There are enough people in that locker room who, and I think that's part of it, is that, you know, you take someone like a Tyreek Hill, you take someone like a Josh Gordon, or even before him, way back when, Corey Dillon, yeah, who was seen as a, you know,
or a Randy Moss, child, a malcontent in Oakland. Certainly, you know, I mean, you can make that argument, yeah, seeing him sitting on the bench, disinterested in the game. And yeah, winning cures a lot of things. Let's, yeah, you know, let's clear that, or, you know, say that right up front. But also, you know, coming in, I'll also say, you know, and they brought in Chad, you know, Johnson, Chad Ochocinco. I mean, they're willing to take these because they want to win, and they are willing, they think they have this support system built. But let's not, you know, before we give them too much credit, they're as quick to bail as anybody, right? When it's time, yes, to bail. And that's part of it. This is not a long term. There are no guarantees here with any of these situations. They're very transient, and people are quick to move on.
Yeah, but you can argue this too, is that maybe part of that is too, is that the team that was hanging on to the player while they're sulking and in bad, behaving badly and not playing well or doing things that they shouldn't do, was enabling those players. Whereas a team that is doing a good job is like, we're going to surround you with people who are going to give you, you know, positive feedback for the things you need to be doing, who are going to be the type of people that are going to encourage you to play to your best and play to your strengths and behave to your strengths. But we're not going to give you any quarter when it comes to you misbehaving. So it's, and to me, I think that's part of it, is that like, this is how you do take chances on players, is that it begins with not so much about what should we expect players, you know, how should we expect players to change? But maybe the first question is, what should our organization be like, and how do we lead so that we know that when we're choosing players with these questions, that we're going to handle it well and that we're going to maximize that opportunity? And part of that is being willing to part ways quickly when they do fail. But at the same time, knowing the shape and tenor of your locker room, because, you know, you may have a locker room where you've got, like, I hear this all the time. Player X getting drafted has this type of problem and they have this type of issues. So, and you'll see fans or media say, well, this team has this veteran and stick him with this veteran and he's going to be just fine. And you're thinking, so you're really going to think that you're going to take this one player and you don't know whether even if their personalities mesh, and say, here, you babysit this guy. That's now your job, is that you're going to emotionally babysit this guy and put your arm around him and be his mentor. He may not even want to be, right, and there may be another eight players on the roster who are more like him. You know, more like the rookie, and he gravitates towards them, and it's pretty much over at that point. You know, and I think that, you know, it's about understanding the character of your team. It's like listening to the story I remember of Frank Gore going on to the 49ers at first, and the 49ers were a team that just partied. This was after Steve Young was gone. T.O. was basically on the way out or already out, and they had guys like Brandon Lloyd, and they had, you know, who was a great player who I always love mentioning how great he was as a pass receiver, but, you know, he wanted to be a rap star, and he was one of those guys that was in and out of the Patriots organization pretty quick. And some of that may have been mental health issues, as some of the things that was reported about him, that may be the case. But their team, this was a team that tended to, after they lost, they'd be joking around in the locker room and talking about where they were going to go out. And a rookie, Frank Gore, I was told, you know, basically stopped everybody in the locker room and just was literally shouting at them and crying after a loss and telling them that, you know, that how they're behaving is completely, you know, antithetical to how a team should behave after they lose a game. And does anybody here care? And that you need to stop acting this way if you want to be on this team. And that's from a rookie, you know, right. So, you know, but it also tells you why
Frank the same comments after this last game.
It is, but it's, and it's true, but there's a reason why Frank Gore's still playing today too. And why, you know, fantasy players are frustrated, you know, to this, you know, this year that he's, you know, basically blocking Kenyon Drake's numbers from what they could be because of basically that character and behavior trait of that's kept him in the game for so long, and to be able to still play at a reasonably high level. So, you know, maybe it is the environment around and what we build with it as opposed to just the player. And you have to, and a lot of these teams, I don't think necessarily realize that. And the ones that do tend to be the better ones. Maybe that's why Al Davis in the early days with the Raiders was so good, is that he could figure out that environment.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things, I mean, you know, players talked about the entitlement. Players generally get a pass, you know, for some period of time. And then they can wear that out. And hopefully that gives them the time they need to figure out what needs to change and to make the changes. And look, we've seen, I mean, you see it, people change. I can think of a number of players who over time, but a lot of it comes with maturity. I mean, you look at guys who were, you know, started out being one thing, Andre Rison, you know, ended up, you know, being a totally different thing by the time he left football. I mean, it's people do evolve and change.
Yeah. And it's funny because sometimes we mistake the components that will help someone change. I mean, you talked about this earlier, which was, players who, you know, a lot of football players or athletes are entitled and they're enabled and they have that kind of stuff. But we sometimes put the wrong picture on the player. I mean, it's like some guys, you know, maybe they go to high school and, you know, we think about them in high school and they're celebrated and they may even be protected by the school system a little bit, you know, maybe not officially, but on some level in the college game, same thing. There's a lot of gaming of things going on within larger universities. That's a whole other topic. But at the same time, you know, you think about the varieties of classes that the, you know, like socioeconomic classes that these players come from and what their environments may be like. And it ranges so crazily that it's like we hear about the stereotypes of it. First, you have like a kid like Christian McCaffrey went to a public high school in Inglewood, Colorado. I know about because my little brother went there. And let me tell you, that's a country club. It might as well be a private school in most places. If that school were in Georgia, where I live, and certain places of Atlanta, where I grew up, that would have been a private school. It wouldn't have been a public school. But he had an NFL father. You know, he had probably all the advantages that he needed to become a terrific player and a mature young man. And when you look at it, he took advantage of every single one of those things. But there are other players. You think about a guy like maybe Connor Cook, who, you know, was playing backup for the Raiders, who had a lot of those advantages of quarterback coaching and different things. And for whatever reason, you know, that hasn't worked out for him in terms of maybe from a talent standpoint. But there are other players who maybe, you know, there are other players who maybe have all those advantages and don't take advantage of it and also are kind of boorish and are just enabled by it as opposed to actually maximizing and working through it. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you'll have guys who, you know, we think of on the other end of the spectrum who come from poor families, who, you know, have maybe one parent who's working and supporting multiple kids, and they're not eating every day. They don't have, you know, they have a few pairs of clothes to wear. And basically they come from, you know, maybe they're in a crime ridden environment on top of that. And maybe they get a little pass in school, like a lot of athletes do, but at the same time, they've seen what hard work is. They've seen bad things. They've seen a lot of stuff happen, and it kind of makes them even more determined with what it is that they do have to get where they want to go. And maybe some of that too is that they have friends who make bad decisions, or they're in, you know, and have done some things that are criminal in behavior, and they get associated with that, and we mistake them as being bad character when it comes to. But then when you see them actually get into an environment where, you know, you realize that they just needed to be in a better environment, you see that the character of their behavior, their discipline, their work ethic, their accountability, all blossom, you know. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you may have someone who comes from a similar environment, but their family just enabled them and said, we're going to shelter you and protect you from everything going on the outside. But we're going to, but at the same time, you're not going to have to work. We're not going to expect you to have to do anything in terms of going to school. You're just going to be the little prince in our household, you know, in this little household. And they don't even realize that they're poor and how poor they are. They don't realize how close to desperation they are in terms of where they live until they've gotten old enough and they look around and go, you know, somebody might say, you know, for Christmas, I can't buy you that PlayStation. And they're looking like completely lost that they can't, that they're not going to get a PlayStation for Christmas, but they don't realize that their family's on welfare and that the mother or father has like basically given them all sorts of, you know, high-end clothing and, you know, and every game they wanted and kind of just pampered them in this little environment and this little bubble to the point that when they step outside, it takes them a couple years to realize that, holy cow, I don't come from a privileged environment, but I was treated as if I was. And then they happen to have one special skill or talent and they haven't done anything with it. And they were just a really good athlete and didn't really refine their skills. And now when they have to be forced to compete and work, they're completely lost, but they're characterized in the same way as the kid who came from the same neighborhood, but saw the things and experienced the things that they didn't and was everything wasn't given to them. So it's like you can be from two opposite ends of the socioeconomic spectrum and still have some similarities, and people will still mistake them and misdiagnose what it is that they're going to be able to contribute or if they're going to be able to contribute to a professional team.
Yeah, so this points to the need for not just individuals to be able to change, but institutions to be able to change, families, schools, professional teams, professional leagues, and on, all right? So, I mean, I think one of the great, you know, something that has to be, and I'm imagining this, projecting a little bit, but when you've gone from being the high school and college superstar to going to the NFL, where you've been the 1% in terms of talent, well ahead and separated from 95% of your teammates because you're that much better, you go to the NFL where all of a sudden you are not the 1%. Everybody's the 1%, right? And maybe that forces some changes on you. But I do think in broader terms, you know, the NFL needs to, you know, they need to make changes. And maybe this is something, you know, look, all changes comes as evolution, and maybe it's going to require new ownership. Maybe a guy like David Tepper is the new wave of owners who comes in and injects some new thought into the way that the NFL handles its business and its personnel. That's part of this change too. I mean, you know, the Patriots seem to have it dialed in, but we can't see behind the scenes. We don't know how this, you know, I don't know how it works. It seems to work more often than not, but maybe that's just a perception and they're able to put the perception out there. It hasn't worked with every single guy they've brought in there, that's for sure. So yeah, so I think, you know, change is great on an individual level. I think change on institutional levels is required as well.
Yeah. So what would you say if we were to try and distill this conversation down either as a recap or anything to add to it? When you're looking at the NFL draft season that's coming up and you start to see reports about how this great player smoked some pot or this great player got into trouble because he, you know, mooned somebody on the bus or got busted for using a fake ID, or this player hit a woman in high school, 4 years ago, and did something that was, you know, obviously a criminal offense and bad behavior. And we've just learned about it, you know, this year. It just becomes public to the, you know, widespread public this year. You know, what kind of advice do you give to people who study the draft, who play fantasy football, who are just football fans when it comes to how they should look at these types of stories?
Context. This is not really super complicated. Put it in context. Put it in, you know, put all occurrences are come within the context of an entire lifetime, whether it's a young person whose life is much shorter or mine. I mean, I would hate for people to decide I am what I was 25 years ago. what I was 30 years ago, what I was 40 years ago. I mean, I'm an evolving, changing thing. We're not a finished product when we're 19, 20 years old. Put it into context. Are there things that are so egregious you can't forgive them? Yeah, likely so. But in general, think back to when you were a younger person, when your decision-making process was not as refined as it is now, when your maturity levels didn't give you the kind of ability to make good decisions and lead to positive outcomes every single time. And even now, how your inability to make all your decisions lead to positive, great outcomes. So this context is the key here. And I think it's difficult when we look at these people through a drinking straw. We're looking at a commodity and not a person. We're looking at something that, you know, that's talked about for 30 seconds at a time on SportsCenter. And that's probably not the way to look at it. It's just the way we're shown it. And so try to look beyond that and put things in context.
Yeah. And I think it is about looking deeper because, I mean, last night I saw this and I think it was Mike Tanier, who does excellent work at Bleacher Report. And he's such a fun columnist to read. And he was complaining about how he was going to be expected probably to have some opinion about Baker Mayfield not having a warm exchange with Hugh Jackson at midfield after the Browns wiped the field with the Bengals, and how that this was a story that was on all the different outlets. And we have to understand that the outlets are about entertainment as much as it is about, down and dirty football, and getting into that level. It's also about they're trying to be morning shows, mm-hmm. just as much, if not more. Now I'm sitting here seeing that and I'm thinking, thank God I don't have to have an opinion to make a living to do this. Like, because that's not who I am and that's not what I'm about, but I understand why other people do, but you have to kind of keep that in context because it's easy as if you're a working Joe who, listen, I think about the 9-to-5s I had or a different career. And I think about, must be nice to be able to, play a professional sport, how fun that would be and how easy that might be on some level if I were just talented and gifted with, and you don't think about, the work that goes in behind that. And there's certain level of that's true is that, if you're gifted and talented with certain things that you envy or somebody else would envy, then, that's a blessing to a certain degree. But at the same time, when you watch these people on TV and then you see someone give a 30-second or 2-minute commentary on ESPN and other people are sitting there in the locker room with you after the workout and they're all making comments here and there that are just really simplistic, you just got to understand that the people who are watching that on TV, they're looking at these people. They're not looking at these people as fully dimensional people. They're characters. They're just characters in life right now. They're not seeing them that way. It's just more characters for their entertainment, for their storyline. And they don't think seriously enough about these people as full-fledged, highly, human beings with a full context of life behind them. And I think that that's where we tend to kind of err in our ways when we talk about looking at character, is that we take that same viewing lens and we never widen or deepen that lens when we look at these players.
I buy that. And just remember when we're watching, the ESPN is and NFL Network and all these things, they're shows. They're not necessarily news.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's The View. It's Good Morning America on the side where they're not showing the news part, and that's fine. And there's things about that the entertainment can be fun. But when they start talking about hard hitting things, but it's with coffee shop locker room talk, then you're not really getting the real story and you're not going to get anything of depth. And if you're going to sit there and argue with someone who actually does understand the story, and there aren't going to be very many, you're just going to be perpetuating that kind of high gloss, low depth, kind of information. And, if you're, And if that's all it is to you, that's fine. But if you're going to try and use that as a real basis for a substantive argument, you're screwed, you know? And I think that that's what happens, is a lot of people apply that to when they start talking about the draft, and they don't think about the draft as really, this is an employment fair for people in their lifetime. And they don't think about that deeper level of what's led up to all of this. They just think about it as their own entertainment. So listen, this was tremendously entertaining for me. And I tend to be very selfish about these podcasts. I hope it was entertaining for everybody else. But Bob, thank you so much for coming on today to have this conversation with me.
Thank you always for having me, and I appreciate the topic and the talk.
Very cool. Well, Bob, you can follow Bob Harris at Football Diehard on Twitter. He is the Football Diehard senior editor and the Sirius XMF fantasy host, and you know, you can certainly find him at footballdiehards.com. And you know, I do know that I'll say, as a footballguy.com, that footballguys.com definitely has talked about publicly they owe a debt to Mr. Football Diehard here. So when I almost said footballguys.com, you can find them there. They might not have existed without Bob Harris. That's where, you know, that's how deep it goes in terms of this industry. And, you know, just for those of you, if you're new to this podcast, you enjoyed it, please rate and review it. It's available. You know, you can do that on Stitcher, iTunes, Blueberry, and Google Play. And, you know, I've got some news coming out about the 2019 Rookie Scouting Portfolio publication. Sometime in December, you'll be getting some news, more news about that. And if you haven't gotten the Rookie Scouting Portfolio before, it's available every April 1st, and there is a post-draft addendum available no later than 1 week after the NFL draft. And I just promise you, if you like this show, or you like the work that I do on YouTube or on Twitter or at footballguys.com, the Rookie Scouting Portfolio publication is by far the best thing that I do every year. And I've been doing it for the past 16 years. You can find it at mattwaldmanrsp.com, and you can take a video tour there. Thanks again, everyone. And I hope you have a wonderful week as we head into December.